left out in the cold? Feel the love this January 29th at the Discorder February issue launch party at the Lido. Admission is free. Featuring Brass, Did You Die, and CITR Femme Concept DJs between sets. Come for a free night of music and the first peek at Discorder's first issue of 2015. Doors open at 8:30 this Thursday, January 29th at the Lido.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen, and then get riding.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 23rd of January, and I'm Sahar.
And I'm Moira Warburton. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:03 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news. Today's top stories and segments are a radio essay by Emily Blake on the Dalhousie University scandal and the politics of rape culture.
We also have segment two, Marco's weekly science and tech update.
Later in the program, Moira Warburton gives us an update on the AMS, including an interview about divestment with EUS President Veronica Knott.
We also have news correspondent Morgan Yee, who spoke with Dr. Bigham of Canadian Blood Services, and Chad Walters, a fourth-year student who worked with NetCAD to organize a rainbow donor clinic to raise awareness about policy issues impacting the ability of men who have sex with men, MSM, to donate their blood.
And lastly, we have Koska Pradanovic, who spoke to Harsha Walia about racial profiling by the Vancouver Transit Authority.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, graduate Peter Allard donates an additional $30 million to UBC Law. On Thursday, UBC christened its law faculty, previously referred to as UBC Law School, the Peter A. Allard School of Law. The name was changed in response to an unprecedented $30 million donation from alumnus Peter Allard. Allard, who was present at Thursday's event, had said, quote, "My intention is to create a permanent and growing revenue stream that will help to recruit and retain outstanding faculty members, provide support to ensure that the most promising students are able to participate, and ensure that exceptional learning programs are offered." 4 years ago, Allard donated $11 million that allowed for the construction of Allard Hall and established the Allard Prize for International Integrity, an award used to promote human rights and anti-corruption efforts. The latest donation will be used to establish permanent endowments to support student initiatives, experiential learning programs, summer employment, and clinical opportunities for students to learn practical skills. The donation is the largest ever given to a law school in Canada.
In local news, Richmond, Surrey, Delta, and Langley continue to grow. Infrastructure lags behind. Jeff Dean, an instructor from the Kwantin Polytechnic University, raises concerns that post-secondary institutions in the South Fraser region of BC has not been keeping up with the region's rising populations. The region is growing rapidly, but the number of spots for full-time post-secondary students isn't keeping up. Therefore, it needs more funding. Dean says that students end up having to pay for the underfunding of post-secondary education by having to commute or move away to attend school. According to census data, one-third of Surrey's population is under 19. The region has been growing exponentially since the early 1990s, and the population as a whole has been increasing 13 to 24% every 5 years since then. Currently, 30% of grade 12 graduates in the lower region attend Kwantin in the South Fraser region, while 33% attend schools elsewhere in the lower mainland. Surrey Board of Trade CEO Anita Haberman predicts that this could potentially harm the region's economy because it will be likely that the students who look in other regions for post-secondary education will work in those regions. The full-time equivalents to population ratios show that the 9 public post-secondary institutions north of the Fraser River have 62.5 seats per 1,000 people, and the 2 post-secondary institutions south of the Fraser River have 12.8 seats for every 1,000 people. Dean says that the numbers have only gotten worse as the region has grown to encompass 21% of the province's population, while funding levels have been decreased. Kwantin, one of the 2 options for post-secondary education in South Fraser Valley, is asking for more government funding and is willing to charge higher tuition in programs where students could expect high salaries after graduation, but the government has capped tuition increases.
In national news, government does not gather data from reserves in unemployment numbers. It has been revealed that Stats Can does not collect data from First Nation reserves on unemployment numbers because the process would be too costly, as well as citing difficulties in finding people to interview. The lack of empirical data in this area means that approximately half of Canada's First Nations are not being accounted for in unemployment numbers. Considering it is a major policy of the current government to decrease unemployment, the lack of stats is a significant hindrance to the implementation of such programs that attempt to target unemployment among Aboriginal youths. Pilot research programs suggest that the rate of unemployment on reserves is 5 times higher than that of the rest of Canada, compared with the data from the 2006 census, which said that the rate of unemployment among Aboriginals was 3 times higher than non-Aboriginals. The pilot research program was declared a success, although suggesting that the current practice of non-collection from reserves will be reassessed, although a study of the program noted that there are still several factors to be overcome.
In international news, the West African Ebola crisis may finally be abating. On Thursday, the World Health Organization announced that the Ebola crisis is in dramatic decline. Over 8,668 people died in the Ebola epidemic last year, but for the last 4 consecutive weeks, new cases of Ebola have been falling in Geneva, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. At the worst of the crisis, U.S. analysts were warning that there could be 1.4 million cases of Ebola by this year. Instead, there have been fewer than 22,000 officially reported cases. Thanks to the noble efforts of health workers, breakthroughs in community engagement, and increased awareness and prevention, the proliferation of the Ebola virus has come to a standstill. However, the World Health Organization urged that it is still far too early to be complacent due to the virus's ability to resurge without proper health precautions set in place. The United Nations stated that it will attempt to raise $1 billion by June this year to eradicate the remaining Ebola hotspots in Western Africa.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have a radio essay by Emily Blake on the Dalhousie University scandal and the politics of rape culture.
Opened on a public discussion about sexual assault, misogyny, and rape culture. Since December, the country has been paying close attention to the dentistry department at Dalhousie University in Halifax, specifically to 13 male fourth-year students, members of the Facebook group called the DDS 2015 Gentlemen. Many have heard the disturbing comments these men have made about their female classmates, including a poll on who they would have hate sex with, and jokes about drugging and raping women. This, ladies and gentlemen, is what rape culture looks like. Women Against Violence Against Women has described rape culture as that which makes, quote, violence against women and sexual coercion seem so normal that people believe rape is inevitable. Rather than viewing the culture of rape as a problem to change, people in rape culture think about the persistence of rape as just the way things are. The comments these men have made are shocking and disappointing, but even more shocking is the way the university's administration has handled the case. Their decision to use restorative justice has been heavily criticized as it places a burden on the victims. Four female dentistry students have refused to participate in the process, claiming that the university pressured them to do so. They have expressed their disappointment in an open letter to University President Richard Florizone, saying the approach has, quote, perpetuated our experience of discrimination. This approach falls far below what we expected from you and what we believe we deserve. The university has now announced its decision to offer separate online classes to the 13 male students who are currently suspended from clinical practice. Many have said this is akin to private tutoring and falls short of public demand to expel the students. The activist hacker collective Anonymous has even threatened to reveal the identities of the students if they are not expelled.
Anonymous makes the following demands. 1. The Dalhousie Senate Discipline Committee will convene a hearing panel in regards to each member of the DDS 2015 Gentlemen Club. 2. Steps to expel all active members and ringleaders will begin immediately. 3. Dalhousie University will immediately begin a thorough investigation into its institutional practices. 4. Dalhousie University will immediately begin work on creating a new plan to address systemic sexism on campus and beyond. 5. Active Gentlemen Club members working at the dentistry school clinic will be forbidden from returning to practice there, with mandatory gender justice training for all clinicians. The clock starts now. If you have not demonstrated compliance by midday Monday, January 5th, the names of all 13 members of the Gentlemen's Club will be released. The ringleaders and most active participants will be identified. Anonymous will identify any staff members who failed to act on this case, were lauded for their misogynistic practices, and the dentistry professor who displayed the sexist video to his class.
Ontario's licensing agency for the dentists has also asked for the names of the 13 students. This case is just one example of how institutions across the country are not taking sexual violence seriously. An investigation by the Toronto Star found that only 9 out of 78 publicly funded universities across Canada have a sexual assault policy. This is a real problem when statistically at least 1 in 4 women will be sexually assaulted in her lifetime, and women are at the greatest risk between the ages of 15 and 24. If other serious crimes were committed at those rates, they would be recognized as a serious epidemic and dealt with such. So why is it that when it comes to violence against women, is the issue not taken seriously? I've thought a lot about how I would feel in this situation, and I ask you to do the same. How would you feel if you found out your classmates made jokes about drugging and sexually assaulting you? What impact would it have on you? On your studies? What if you were assaulted? How would you feel if your university didn't take it seriously? This is not just a case of boys will be boys, young foolish men talking about women as they are wont to do. I'm sure that most men I know would be offended if someone were to claim that this is just how men talk. And yet, that is how our culture treats this kind of behavior. These are fourth-year professional students who, if they graduate in May, will be seeking employment at dentistry practices where they will have access to drugs and be in positions of trust and power. They will be working both with female colleagues and on female patients. This isn't just a case of morality or human decency, although I think that is grounds enough to take the issue seriously. But more importantly, it's a matter of public safety. I can't say for sure what the best solution in Dalhousie's case is. The school has launched both an internal and external investigation into how the dentistry faculty handled the scandal. I am interested to see what they will ultimately decide. Regardless, it will send an important message to the country about the value of young women's safety. It's time that sexual violence gets taken more seriously.
Thank you, Emily. We would like to offer a quick correction. Earlier we misspoke and said Ebola cases were declining in Geneva. What we meant to say was Guinea. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here at CITR 101.9 FM.
CITR has revived. Its long dormant beginner show, It Ain't Easy Being Green. With the support of experienced programmers, this show offers fully trained CITR members, especially students, the opportunity to get on the air.
Thursday, THURSDAY.
11.
It Ain't Easy Being Green on CITR 101.9 FM.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have Marco's weekly science and tech update.
Good afternoon. And our lead story, the title is One Nanoparticle, Six Types of Imaging. Researchers at the University of Buffalo have designed a particle that can be detected by six different types of medical imaging techniques. The research appears in the January 14th Journal of Advanced Materials, and it is called Hexamodal Imaging with Porphyrin Phospholipid-Coated Upconversion Nanoparticles. That's right, it's about a nanoparticle. But this technology is so advanced that the machine capable of doing it doesn't exist yet. In present-day scans, sometimes fluids or things are injected into a person to do a particular type of scan. But there's many types of scan, such as CT scans, PET scans, MRIs, photoacoustic imaging, fluorescence imaging, upconversion imaging, and Chernenkov luminescence imaging. If a person wants to have all these images done, they have to go under a different machine and have six or seven different injections. But researcher Jonathan Lovell at the University of Buffalo, who is an assistant professor of medical engineering, has invented this new nanoparticle that could be injected into a person and it could be detected by all these scans. Jonathan Lovell says, and quote, "Once such a system is developed, a patient can go into one machine for one scan instead of multiple machines for multiple scans." Lovell has used the nanoparticles on mice to examine their lymph nodes. It was used on a PET scan and a CAT scan and on photoacoustic imaging. All three showed different aspects of the lymph nodes, so this was very helpful instead of undergoing multiple scans. With one scan, doctors can get a clearer image of what's happening inside the body. with the merging of multiple scans, then doctors can do one scan instead of six or seven. But the machine to do it is not invented yet. In our next story, in environmental news, NASA and researchers at UCLA in Los Angeles are studying the rivers that are draining from Greenland. In their study, they say the rivers of the glacial meltwater flown over Greenland's ice sheet surface may be contributing as much to global sea level rise as all other factors in the world combined. Greenland is the size of the Rocky Mountains of the U.S., west of the Rocky Mountains, that is. It is covered by ice, and the researchers are using different techniques to study this global ice melt. Greenland's ice sheet is difficult to study from the ground, so NASA is contributing with satellite images. In the research, they are learning how much water remains on the ice sheet in the summer and how much drains to the ocean. What they found is virtually all of the flowing water is draining into the ocean. The research methods include two different types. One, a drone is used to measure the depth of the water and how much light reflects off it. In the other method, a satellite measures the depth of the surface water from the satellite image and determines how much water is flown into the ocean. The robots or drones measure the depth, the stream flow velocity, and the temperature as the water swept downstream. The result was glacier water melt from Greenland is contributing as much as all other factors on the Earth combined. These findings appear in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in this month's issue. In other environmental news, this is to do with sequestration of CO2. CO2 is a harmful greenhouse gas, but scientists have now invented in the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, have invented a new method called carbon sequestration, where they will inject the CO2 7,000 feet below the Earth's surface into salty brine. They have stated that when they do this, the CO2 will harden and will no longer pose a threat to the atmosphere. But researchers at MIT in the Department of Earth, Atmosphere, and Planetary Sciences said once the CO2 is injected in the ground, less CO2 is converted to rock than previously thought. Some of the CO2 that is converted to rock blocks the other two that are the other amount that is attempted to be converted into rock. So what percentage turned into rock is a question. And in the last story, a quick story on astronomy. Tonight at 10:41 p.m., there will be a rare triple transit of Venus. Three of its moons will move across the surface of Jupiter. The moons are Io, Callisto, and Europa. If you miss this, the next transit isn't too far off. It's only March 20, 2032. This is Science and Technology News. You're up to date with the latest findings.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM. Hi, I'm Moira Warburton, here with your AMS report for CITR News.
AMS Food Bank. Your access to money during the studies at UBC will most likely be limited, but it is a priority of the AMS Food Bank to ensure your access to food is not. The AMS Food Bank provides emergency food relief 7 days a week for all UBC students. To volunteer with the Food Bank or for inquiries about how to take advantage of the services provided, contact them at foodbank@ams.ubc.ca. For more information, find the AMS Food Bank on Facebook or feel free to visit anytime across from the Wellness Center and Sprouts.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
For our next segment on the show, we have Moira Warburton gives us an update on the AMS, including an interview about divestment with EUS President Veronica Knott.
Hi, I'm Moira Warburton, here with your AMS report for CITR News 101, reporting on the AMS meeting that happened last night, Wednesday, January 21st. So it looked like it wasn't going to be a very eventful meeting, and then it ended up being quite an eventful meeting. The sub update schedule is on track for like the third or fourth week in a row. I'm pretty sure this is a new record. I think we should all be celebrating this. Schedule is again tentatively on track. And the research team, they have a research team that's going on how to animate the new sub. So this means like putting in foosball tables and I would assume paint jobs and stuff. They're going to be researching this by looking at other universities, seeing what they've done with their cool subs. So that's exciting. There was a student at large statement from Julie, didn't catch the last name, geological engineer at UBC. She was again with UBC C350. They're extremely determined. You got to give them credit. She was here reminding the AMS that they have a responsibility to make referendum decisions into policy, referring to the referendum that was done last year about divesting UBC of dirty fuel investments. We will be talking about this more. This was ended up being a huge discussion item at the meeting last night. And I'll also be talking to Veronica Knott, president of the EUS, later on in this segment. The president's remarks, pretty uneventful. There's a memorial service today for the two UBC students killed a couple of weeks ago while hiking. It's in the old auditorium at 7:30 p.m. If anyone wants to go to that, they're welcoming the whole UBC community. Anyone who wishes to go can do so. It's starting at roughly 7:30 p.m., he said. In finance, the finance report, we received $250,000 in bursary money, so that's awesome. They're going to be figuring out where that will be best spent. New money is always great. The executive director, Daniel Lavangi, said that we received funding to collaborate with the Faculty of Law to expand the sexual assault center, the SASC. So that's good. And block party planning is starting. Yay! So those were basically the only other things that were discussed at the meeting last night. Like I said, it was going to be a short meeting, and then divestment came up, and then it wasn't. This has been on the agenda so many times. The AMS is trying to move the referendum decision, which was to divest UBC, into AMS policy. So this came up last night, and Veronica Knott, the EUS president, came out and said, engineering supports the idea of divestment, we just don't support this policy because it hasn't had any consultation process. So that was the general opposition's point. We haven't really had any consultation. There was no education. There wasn't a balanced advocacy for each side. It was basically just divest, 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 when we didn't look at the impacts on this would have on students. The other side saying yes, divest, was saying that there's not really anything we can do about this. We've taken a referendum. We have a responsibility to honor that referendum. Here is a segment of me talking to Veronica Knott. We have here Veronica Knott, president of the EUS, who is going to talk to us a bit about the statement she gave last night at last night's AMS meeting regarding UBC's policy on divesting investments from fossil fuel sources. So, Veronica, do you want to just sum up quickly the statement that you gave to the AMS regarding divestment?
Basically, we didn't take a stance against divestment or for divestment. We wanted to focus specifically on the policy that the AMS was passing yesterday. This policy was two parts. There was an actual policy, and it referenced a briefing note. And the EUS had major concerns with the briefing note that was attached. So this briefing note was written by UBC C350 and the AMS. And we felt it wasn't representative of all students on campus and how this policy and this referendum were going to negatively affect a large or a minority of students on campus. And so for us, we wanted to see briefing notes and policies written by the AMS that at least acknowledge the students that were going to be affected negatively by this and represent all students and not just a small segment that passed this referendum.
Yeah, so just to clarify, the UBC 350 is a lobbyist group who have been lobbying quite determinedly for UBC to go through with divestment. So why is this
yours/the US's position? Like, how will divestment negatively affect the student body?
Well, so that's something that's really interesting to talk about, because divestment, in a sense, is very separate from the fossil fuel issue that's going on. So UBC C350 believes that divestment is the biggest stance that we can take against fossil fuel extraction. But divestment actually means that the university has to remove all of its investments in these companies. And they've proved that there isn't going to be an economic issue for the university, i.e. like our endowment funds aren't going to decrease because they divest. But they haven't really thought about what's going to happen for students who go and get hired in these companies, and for like the grants and funds these companies put onto our campus. And unfortunately, all of those students are really concentrated in engineering. Like, there are some in commerce and arts, but a majority of them will be in engineering. And these are students who spend their degrees learning about extraction, and they want to go get work in the fossil fuels industry. Or the Shell Student Fund, which funds almost all of our engineering design teams. And so these are huge amounts of money and jobs that, if we divest, won't necessarily affect the university as a whole economically, but the companies will be less inclined to come hire our students, because right now Shell sends 4 or 5 representatives and they fly them out from Calgary and they put them up in hotels so they can stay at our career fair and come meet our students. And if with the fossil fuel industry in a decline like it is right now, to say something like, oh, we're going to divest from this company, they may be less inclined to send these reps. Like, we don't have that proof. And what we're asking for is the AMS to go and do some consultation and work with these industry officials and these reps to find out how bad these like risks will be for students and how negatively they will be affected, and if there is ways to mitigate these problems. So at least we can divest and UBC C350 can have the statement against fossil fuel extraction, but we won't be severely affecting the livelihoods of a huge minority of students on campus. And I say huge minority because I don't want this to sound like 5% of students on campus. I'm like, this is around 30% of students that are going to be negatively affected by this. So I know it's a bit of a bad use of words, but
it's a minority, but it's like a decent minority. It's
yeah.
Not like, yeah, like 2%, like you were saying.
Yeah.
So UBC is looking at divestment, but a lot of universities are also looking at divestment. Why is it such a big deal for UBC?
So UBC has one of the most extensive engineering programs, especially focusing in the extraction industry. So you look at surrounding schools around us, they have larger amounts of students in computer or electrical, but we have a large amount of students in mining or materials or chemical and biological, civil, mechanical, and all of these disciplines go on to get hired in the fossil fuel extraction industry or even the mining extraction industry, which are very closely linked. And so we just have this like huge amount of students compared to all of the universities close to us, but also to a lot of schools across Canada. And the schools you are seeing really push for divestment don't have as large amount of students in these industries. And so they won't have this like strong effect on hiring and funds as other schools potentially might.
So what do you hope to see change with the AMS's execution or like decision-making process about the policy? What do you want to see different?
Well, for us, last night in the 3 hours of conversation, we touched on a lot about what we were asking for in this case was a briefing note that was written differently. And we wanted this briefing note to be written with both sides and acknowledging the minority and mitigating risks. But what this has actually become has been more of a question about how the AMS handles referendums and how they respond to referendums. Because as we know, the referendum is the highest form of student consultation. And once a referendum passes, the AMS is obliged, but they're directed to follow this. And we want to see them, when they're writing these referendums, to consider both the majority and the minority and write briefing notes that are not written by one group of students or one lobbying group on campus, but are reflective and representative of all students.
Yeah, or at least not like, you know, seriously influenced by one, but just like giving a more balanced view of UBC students. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Veronica.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Moira. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Are you not sure where to go on campus? Traveling late at night and afraid to go alone? Call SafeWalk, a free service where a co-ed team will take you anywhere you need to go on campus. Don't walk alone. For a walk, add SafeWalk to your phone. Call 604-822-5355. That's 604-822-5355. Alternatively, use a UBC Blue phone and ask for SafeWalk, approach any SafeWalk team, or drop by our office on the main floor of the sub across from the gallery lounge.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Moira Warburton.
And I'm Sahar. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us.
Up next on the program, we have news correspondent Morgan Yee, who spoke with Dr. Mark Bigham of Canadian Blood Services, and Chad Walters, a fourth-year student who worked with NetCAD to organize a rainbow donor clinic to raise awareness about policy issues impacting the ability of men who have sex with men, MSM, to donate their blood.
Chad and Mark, welcome to News 101. So for listeners who maybe haven't heard about the Rainbow Donor Clinic, can you provide a brief description of what it's all about? Chad, maybe I'll get you first.
So it refers to an event that will be held February 4th from 12 to 7 at NetCAD here on UBC campus. So a blood clinic is where people can go to donate blood, and sometimes specific blood types are requested, whether that's A positive, AB, O, etc. And when we say rainbow blood, we're referring to donors from the gay community who are commonly deferred from making donations for transfusion. The event is more than merely providing blood. It also provides an opportunity to learn about how gay men can still save lives. And it provides a space where we can dialogue with Canadian Blood Services staff and other LGBTQ community partners. And it's intended to be fun. There'll be some prize draws, some food, some music, I hope. And you'll also be able to learn your blood type for those people who have yet to learn it. It's more than just donating blood. It's about engaging the community.
Chad, you're a student here at the university. You're in social work. So how did you first get involved with this project?
This project specifically stemmed from a policy class that we had last semester. And I was investigating policies around blood donations. Originally, back when I was 18, I went to donate blood and I was deferred. And there wasn't much information provided to me, and it felt, it ignited some fire inside of me. And since then, I've been involved and engaged.
Mark, how did you get involved?
I'm one of the physicians at the Vancouver Centre for Canadian Blood Services. So we want this, as Chad was saying, to be an opportunity for the gay community to ask questions of Canadian Blood Services staff, to inquire further about eligibility and where issues related to specifically the criteria around men who have sex with men.
And Chad, you mentioned that it was a policy course that first got you really engaged with this issue. What is the current policy on who can donate blood?
There's quite a number of policies that lead to deferrals or eligibility. The one that we're kind of focusing on here is the MSM policy, which states that a man who has sex with men is only eligible to donate had they not had any sexual engagement for 5 years. This is a newer policy that came into effect in 2013.
Correct.
The past used to be a lifetime deferral, and now it's moved to 5 years. So there has been some progress made here.
And do you know why those changes were made? Was it a lot of community engagement that brought on the change from a lifetime deferral to a five-year deferral?
There was. There was a convergence of a number of factors that led to the change from an indefinite deferral, essentially, to a time-limited, albeit longer period, five-year deferral. But that's nonetheless a sea shift change, I think, as a first step anyways. One of the issues related to our increasing understanding of the epidemiology of HIV in both Canada but also in the international context. A number of other blood operators in other countries, such as in Australia and the United Kingdom, other countries have moved to a one-year deferral policy. And in fact, in Australia, where this policy has been in place for over a decade, there's been some very good published evaluations that have indicated that in moving from an indefinite to a one-year deferral criterion for men who have sex with men, there was actually no incremental increase in donor risk with respect to HIV risk for patients receiving that blood. So there was an international move to shorter time frames, There's also been some mathematical modeling work done that have shown that the risk is extremely low, something in the neighborhood of potentially, this is in the theoretical range, one potential HIV transfusion transmitted case in 500 years, moving to a five-year time frame. So a very, very low incremental risk. I think most significantly, and I think Chad briefly alluded to this, was the importance of engaging a wide spectrum of stakeholders around this issue. So that includes the general population, donors, advocates for gay rights, but also patient advocates too, including representatives from the Canadian Hemophilia Society, for example. So trying to engage a wide spectrum of people to try and find some consensus where there's comfort in moving to a shorter time frame. And in fact, we are evaluating the impact of that change since it was implemented in July 2013. And indeed, the first year's evaluation has indicated that we've recruited a small number of persons who had a background history of contact with another male, so male with contact with another male. We've enrolled somewhere in the neighborhood of 70, which is not that many. And there's been no evidence of any increased risk to patients. So that's an important first step.
Now, I'm not very familiar with the processes for donating blood and for how the safety of that blood would be tested. You know, if you're looking at, does this blood contain HIV?
Right.
How does that process actually work?
Yeah. Well, the process starts with a questionnaire where we identify risk factors that in general have been associated with an increased risk of certain blood-borne pathogens. And in the case of HIV, one of the recognized potential risk factors is men who have sex with men. And that's based on the epidemiology of HIV in Canada. We have approximately 70,000 people in Canada who have HIV. There is a disparity in the proportion of the both the prevalence and the annual incidence of HIV between potential donors who indicate a past history of, in the case of a male, sexual contact with another male versus a male who doesn't. And so on the basis of that difference, we have identified that MSM is a risk factor. By the time we actually screen the people and test them, so we've already essentially deferred people from even being tested who identified that particular risk factor. So the risk in the general population in Canada for HIV is about 1 in 500. By the time we initially screen the donors and then test them, the risk based on 2013, for example, where we identified two donors with HIV in Canada, the risk drops, and we have about 500,000 donors, so the risk drops to 1 in 250,000. So there's a significant increment in safety right there. Then we test those people and we only release the blood that tests negative. Our HIV screening comprises two tests. We do an antibody test, which is a reflection of the body's immune system's response to infection, and that takes some weeks to kick in. And then there's a more sensitive nucleic acid test that actually looks for the presence of the virus itself in the blood. And that has quite a short window period. We're looking at probably 10 days or less. Mm. So very sensitive. And between those two tests, we can identify people who may not be aware that they're infected. Because estimates are for about up to 25% of persons who may be infected with HIV may not even be aware that they're infected. So by the time we've tested people and only released the blood that's test negative, we're down to a residual risk for the patient of about 1 in 8 million. So that's a 16,000-fold decrease in prevalence from the general Canadian population.
And now, Chad, we talked a little bit about before the interview that NETCAD is very different than other donor clinics, and you've been able to donate blood for research. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and your experience working with NETCAD?
Yeah, sure. So it's important to know that people who are commonly, or people who are maybe deferred for, you know, this reason or that reason, or because of the MSM issue, they may very well be eligible to donate at NETCAD. And for me, I was really interested and really willing to give blood donations. And, you know, NETCAD facilitated that drive for me. So that's what sets it aside from other clinics, is that, you know, it's more inclusive, and it has the potential really to save millions of lives through some scientific discovery of sorts. So I like to think about my donations as potentially saving, yes, millions, as opposed to maybe a select handful of blood recipients.
So now, in terms of people who receive deferrals, how big of a population is that, and how much of an impact does that have on the amount of blood that is being donated?
Unfortunately, there's a lot of people who can't donate blood for a whole variety of reasons that relate not only to safety of the blood that goes into the patient from the patient's perspective, but also we want donation to be safe for the donor as well. So if the donor has a history of, say, fainting or lightheadedness or low iron.
So is there like a shortage of blood available to give to people who need it at this point?
There isn't right now, but it's always a challenge, particularly for some of the blood groups. We have an increasingly diverse patient population in Canada, reflecting immigration from all over the world. Blood actually differs quite a bit according to ethnicity. So people that come from various parts of the world have different specific proteins on the surface of their red cell that may not be compatible with the red blood cells from people that come from other parts of the world. So this is an increasing challenge to Canadian Blood Services and to hospitals, is to try and find sufficient blood to provide to the wide range of patient needs here.
Chad, so in terms of the Rainbow Donor Clinic, what do you feel like is the biggest issue that you would hope that would be addressed by having this kind of event?
I think that it's time to change the dialogue around blood, especially within the gay community. You know, it's talked of a lot of the times in a heavy tone, or perhaps with, you know, a heavy heart. Some people are feeling rejected or discriminated against. And I feel like having a rainbow clinic like this is showing how we can do today something while we're waiting for what we may be able to do tomorrow. To me, it's kind of addressing or countering the negative dialogue and, you know, taking a new spin on an old issue and participating where we can. You know, I hear a lot of the times that people say, I can't donate because I'm gay. And each time I hear this, you know, it raises my flag in my mind, because I know that I'm deferred, but I'm not deferred because I'm gay. I'm deferred because of my higher risk activities, irregardless of sexual identity. And that is one of the main things that drove me to bring this event up with NETCAD. It's not because you're gay. Whether or not you're gay, straight, bisexual, or whatever you are on this spectrum, you know, it's about the higher risk activities. And for me, that was an important shift in acknowledging and accepting the MSM policy. So I'm really hoping that the gay community can see that it is really not about you being gay.
Chad or Mark, do you have anything else you'd like to add?
Yeah, I'd also just like to add that I'm hoping to see some accountability within the gay community, in the sense that, yes, high HIV rates are part of the reason for deferral, and what is being done in the community to mitigate those high rates of HIV. I mean, we have to take a little bit of ownership, a lot of ownership, on ourselves to reduce the transmission of HIV. We can't just be mad that we're deferred. We have to acknowledge why we're deferred. So that's another thing that I think is important to acknowledge. And, of course, to acknowledge that Canadian Blood Services is doing a lot to move forward on this. They put a lot of effort, a lot of hours, years of engaging so many stakeholders and people involved. And I think that Canadian Blood Services deserves some thanks and some gratitude for the efforts that have been put forward.
And if people want to get involved, how can they do that?
By coming to the event, of course, February 4th, 12 to 7, spreading the word. Even if you don't necessarily want to donate blood, you can come out to the Rainbow Donor Clinic. It is an open house, so you can learn. You can learn your blood type. You can learn how you can maybe participate in the One Match program, which is another alternative way of saving lives